Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Lots of folks on the line, so I know we got exciting conversations to have this hour. It's open forum. Can ask whatever you like, and he is back. We haven't seen him in a long time. At least it feels like a long time. Mark Brumley, the president of the most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. That would be the Ignatius Press. Mark Brumley, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Cy. I haven't been with you in about 300 years, I think.
Is that what it is, about 300 years?
About 300 years, yeah.
Well, you're the only, maybe one of the few guys I can tell about this, but something very unfortunate has happened to me in the time since
I've
seen. I've switched from being a Star Trek guy to a Star Wars guy.
Well, okay. That's a little bit like saying I've switched from, well, I won't go there. I was going to go to the sports analogy, but you know what? I find I can't win with sports analogies, but okay. So what has brought this conversion about?
I find that the Star Trek shows now are just like preachy and whiny. And the Star Wars
show. Have you seen the latest Star Wars movies? I mean.
Yeah, I guess it's The Mandalorian that got me.
It was okay.
It was so pleasant. It was just a fun cowboy type movie. I mean, TV show.
That's legit.
Oh, all
that's
right.
Legit.
Well, I thought you might understand. I don't know. Are you still? Star Trek doesn't bug you anymore? I mean, what they're doing nowadays?
Everything bugs me what they're doing nowadays.
What? Two old men talking to Aaron. My lawn.
So now what you got to do is my son-in-law, who's a theology professor, he and I talk about these things a lot. And I say, you know, what's worked for me when it comes to popular culture, even less popular culture, is to keep my expectations low. And then I'm not disappointed. So I pretty much, you know, it's like when you were a kid, you didn't realize that, you know, in the original Star Trek series, that the sets were actually kind of silly looking, you know, because you had no basis of comparison. But, you know, you grow up, you learn more about science and real spaceships and things of that sort. And then you go back and you watch and you look at those sets and they're kind of silly looking. Okay, well, what do? You adjust your expectation. I don't expect that a 1960s TV show is going to have an accurate, given all the limitations of budget and knowledge and all that, is going to have anything approaching an accurate depiction of a spaceship. And the same thing is true of women going around in miniskirts, you know, in the old Star Trek show. I mean, it's just silly stuff. When you look at it now, you say,
wait, are we saying that was bad or that was good?
That was bad.
Oh, that's bad. Okay. I just want to make sure I was following you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's bad that women were depicted in such a demeaning way. Huh. Now, when I was a boy, I probably looked at it differently, but anyway. But that was bad. So how does this relate to apologetics?
I don't know. Oh.
You asked that, don't you? Isn't that what you're asking internally? Like,
yes.
How in the world?
Mark, how does,
get
this,
from here?
How does this? Well, I guess here's my thing, Mark Brumley, when I feel like most of what I watch on television is promoting social change in some way or another, like that, and it involves social changes that I think actually hurt people, don't make people happier or healthier.
Yeah,
it starts to be like, I'm just going to watch The Mandalorian.
I think that's fine, you know, but there's no moral obligation to watch pop culture. In fact, there can be a moral obligation to not watch pop culture.
Yeah.
But if you're going to watch it, you need to, I think different ways you can go with that. So, I agree. There are all kinds of things but let's go back to the Star Trek example, right? Yeah. We have a TV show in the 60s depicting the future which is supposed to be progress, right? It's not depicting an apocalyptic future
or
dystopian future. It's a utopian future where religion plays almost no role, where men and women engage in all kinds of sexual misconduct. I mean, it's not shown explicitly.
No, but you're right.
Because it's 1960s TV. That's right.
Yeah.
And all kinds of questionable moral situations arise. And because we bring to that a certain expectation, we don't look at that as corrupting American society. But I can tell you, as a young boy who watched the girls running around in miniskirts in Star Trek, it had a certain morally corrupting influence. Now it's tame compared to stuff today.
No, but I see what you're saying.
So we look at those things differently through a different lens and we become acclimated to their morally objectionable components. But they were there.
That's a good point.
Not as problematic as some things today. But then some things today, problematic from a certain point of view, but then from a certain point of view, I'm giving a Star Wars reference there. But then from another perspective, they actually are more faithful. They've got a point. I'll put it that way. I'll say one or two cheers. For these kind of politically correct woke shows, there's usually a valid point. The difficulty is they take them to extremes. They go too far.
Yeah, right.
And that becomes harmful to society. So, yeah. But you know, you go back and my wife and I occasionally watch old TV shows, you know, like The Honeymooners or like the Dick Van Dyke Show. And you see that some of the storylines in those shows are horrible, morally speaking.
Really?
Just horrible.
On Dick Van Dyke Show with Mary Tyler Moore?
Yeah, you know, suspected infidelity and all this kind of stuff.
Oh.
As a comic point. And you say, well, wait a minute. You know, I didn't remember that one as a kid. Of course you didn't because you were a kid. You know? But or The Honeymooners. I mean, my daughter and I were talking about how, you know, you watch The Honeymooners. And Ralph.
Yeah.
You know, the way he talks to Trixie, you know, is it Trixie or Alice? It's Alice. Trixie's the other woman. Ralph, the way he talks to Alice, you know, it's hard to watch in light of your knowledge of domestic violence. You know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
They're not promoting domestic violence. That wasn't in anybody's mind at the time, but we're much more conscious of it. So these things have certainly they can have an innocence to them when watched from a certain point of view, but then looked at from another point of view, they can all have all kinds of problematic elements.
Yeah.
And you know what? This is not a new issue. This was an issue for Augustine reading pagan literature, you know? And it's been a perennial problem with Christians. How do we encounter the evil in the world? And in fact, you can have this, so we could have the same conversation, not about pagan literature, but about things in the Bible. You know, I'm doing the Bible year thing now, and I just came across a section of the Bible that deals with the rape of Dinah, you know, and there it is right there in the Bible, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I know I'm going off on a tangent.
I started on a tangent. Like I started the actual show on a tangent. So I don't think you went off on a tangent. I asked for it and I got it. I just want my flying around in spaceship shows to just be about people flying around in spaceships. I think that's a simple thing to want.
The Mandalorian is an exception. There's going to be very little innocence nowadays.
Well, all right, Robert.
I don't hold out hope that the Mandalorian is going to long endure.
No, I'm sure. Right. There's probably things I overlooked there as well. Robert, Missouri, you're first up. Thanks for your call, Robert. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
It is indeed a privilege to talk to Catholic Answers.
Oh, thank you.
I was just wondering, historically, in terms of the town of Bethlehem in Israel, we have three, as I know of, people in the Old two in the Old Testament and Jesus Christ. First of all, being Jesse.
Yeah.
Then David. Jesse, I think, was born in Bethlehem. I'm not sure. But as far as King David, I think he lived there for a while. But I don't think he was born.
Oh, yes, yes.
There.
He was born in Bethlehem, right.
Huh.
Yeah.
And then Jesus Christ was born there. And as in Micah prophecy, he calls Bethlehem the house of bread. So the simple question is, what is the way that Christians recognize Bethlehem as being the center of, in many ways, the origin of leaders compared to, indeed, the Jewish people as of Jesse and David were Israelites or Jewish. Could you compare the two?
I have not been to Bethlehem, but maybe you know about the Christian presence and honoring.
Well, of course, Christians, when Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire, Christians, you know, they had built up Bethlehem and had churches there and so on. But Bethlehem came under the domination of Islam. And to this day, there's a fair amount of tension, not Islamic tension, although there are elements of that. But now Bethlehem is in the Jewish state of Israel, and there's a lot of regulation about who can get in and into Bethlehem and who can leave Bethlehem and so on. So it's not as – although there are churches there and there's an effort on the part of Christians to you know, continue to represent the great dignity of the city of Bethlehem, Christians are in some ways a persecuted minority in Bethlehem. They find themselves between Islamic Palestinians and Jewish authorities, you know, and so there's a lot of challenges for Christians living in Bethlehem these days.
I hope that that's helpful. There's there is a church where Christ was born, right? They built
Church of the Nativity. Sure.
Oh yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. Yeah, Church of the Nativity. Robert, I hope it was helpful. I got to take a quick break because I ended up talking so much about Star Wars and Star Trek with Mark Brumley.
No, yeah. I did.
You blame yourself for the things that I start. All right, we'll be right back.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We continue with Open Forum with Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. They publish fantastic books and they make videos and they do all kinds of stuff over there. It's a full-fledged media company over there, so check them out at Ignatius.com. You got any books this year like, "Oh, I wish he would ask me about this book." You got anything like you're really proud of right now?
Well, I do. I don't have a copy to show the people that are watching online, but we just came out. This is kind of a little geeky thing. I'll admit that. We came out with a very superb edition of Henri de Lubac's book, Church Paradox and Mystery, which is a wonderful little book on the mystery of the church, reflecting the teaching of the Second Vatican Council. And Henri de Lubac, or Henry de Lubac, wrote this book in 67, 68, something like that. Or at least that's when it was first published. And we came out with a revised translation, updated edition, very nice. And
nice.
It really is an important book. It's an important book, and I know it's going to sound theologically geeky, but it really isn't, because it shows how this great man of the church in the 20th century saw the council, the Second Vatican Council, which is much maligned in some Catholic circles these days and much misappropriated in other Catholic circles these days. So
wonderful. Yeah.
He does a great job on that. So it's called Church Paradox and Mystery.
All right. I'm going to look for that. I'm glad. And I mean, what a wonderful man. And one of the, Paridi, right? Is that what?
Yeah, he was a paritus.
He was one of the theologians of the council, so he was right there for the whole thing. And I was like him because when I say his name, I feel like I speak a foreign language. Henri de Lubac.
Henri de Lubac.
All right, let's go to Brian in Ireland watching on YouTube. Brian, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
How are you guys? Love your show, by the way.
Thank you very much. Love your whole country.
That's right.
Yeah, it's getting near my bedtime now, so I'll make it quick.
All right, good. Okay. Go ahead.
So, it's not an original question. You probably have heard this loads of times, but it's a kind of a concern of mine. I'd like to know your view on how receiving the Holy Eucharist on the tongue as opposed to on the hand. Me myself personally, I don't like to receive on the hand. I receive on the tongue and kneeling. But I've been refused a couple of times by, depending on which church I go to. And they've told me to come up at the end of Mass. But it's kind of given me this anxiety every time just before I receive Holy Communion. It's on my mind, like,
yeah,
when I go up, I want to receive on the tongue, and it becomes kind of overwhelming. And I'm just wondering what your view is on that.
Do you mind me asking, is it since the COVID, or has it been always that way with you?
With them, yeah, well, they've... Since the COVID, like before, it was like up to yourself, tongue or the hand. But now they kind of advise just to put it on the hand.
Yeah.
But I've just the Holy Spirit's kind of telling me don't do it. Like I don't feel worthy. I don't feel worthy taking the tongue.
Yeah.
But I definitely don't feel worthy taking the hand. So it's just I feel this kind of anxiety just before communion. It kind of disrupts my prayers.
Yes.
Before communion, and it's like. It's like because everyone seems to take on the hand because they've been advised to.
Right.
So I tend to wait till the end, but I still have this anxiety going up. Like, and I'm thinking, like, am I being judged here? Does he think he's kind of holier than thou because he's kneeling and taking on the tongue? And you know, it's an uncomfortable feeling, you know.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure it's a consequence of, you know, the many, many divisions that we have, and we do judge one another in the church these days. And I'm not advertising for it, but I know we do it. So, Mark, how would you approach your answer to this?
Well, I would say first of all, Brian, appreciate your struggling with this, and I think you're receiving communion on the tongue. There's nothing wrong with that. I understand in the current situation with COVID, you know, in some places there that practice is frowned upon because they for reasons that they regard as having to do with health, but and safety, but you know, you're being allowed to receive communion in a tongue, then you shouldn't feel, you know, as long as you're careful and they're careful, you shouldn't feel bad, and don't worry about people thinking that you think that you're holier than they are. It may just be that part of your Eucharistic devotion is offering that suffering up, because it is a kind of suffering where you're not intending to come across to other people as if you think you're holier than they are, but there is that possibility. You're aware that there's that possibility. It's kind of suffering that you endure, and I think you should try to say, offer that up to Jesus and say, Lord, I'm just doing what I think you're asking of me, and I'm going to do that, you know, even though other people may think ill of me for that, I'm going to do what I think you're asking me. So that's what I would say to you with respect to what you're experiencing. Now, with respect to what the church allows us to receive communion in the hand or communion on the tongue. Communion in the hand was more commonly practiced in the ancient church, in the medieval and up until, you know, basically the 60s in the Roman Rite. Communion on the tongue was the more common practice, and so many people feel that it's more devout, or because it's more traditional, and there's more of an experience of being fed by Christ rather than, you know, receiving communion in your hand and then taking the host yourself. That's how some people see it. Not everybody sees it that way. Pope Benedict XVI said on this question, as he was asked about why in papal masses he had restored the practice of people kneeling and receiving communion on the tongue. He said it wasn't because there's something wrong with communion in the hand. He just felt that many people were taking communion too lightly, and by doing this extra gesture, he was underscoring, as he said, that Jesus is here. This isn't just some ceremony or some practice, but Jesus himself is here. Now, not everybody who receives communion in the hand has that sort of trivial, superficial attitude towards receiving the Lord. Yeah. So we shouldn't assume that's necessary in order to devoutly and piously receive communion. You can receive communion. And so, as I say, Benedict said he's both given and received communion in the hand himself. And so that it's not wrong or bad or evil or spiritually inferior, but he took this gesture to underscore a particular point. And I think sometimes and that's a point that's worth underscoring. Now, it's not the only way we can express that, and and what we should do and what we should encourage is people to be devoutly receiving the Eucharist, whether they receive communion on the tongue or they receive communion in hand, understand who it is they are receiving and behave accordingly. So that's what I'd say. And I do both. So it depends on circumstance and situation. Personally, sometimes I receive communion on the tongue kneeling, which tends to be what happens at Ignatius Press, because we have we've set things up where there's something akin to an altar rail in our little chapel, but it, you know, most parishes that's not the situation. Nothing wrong with people want to kneel and receive on the tongue. Priests should accommodate them, and so I think we're a big church and we have room for both of those expressions of spirituality.
Does that help you, Brian?
That was very, very good. Thanks very much for your help. Thanks a million. God bless you.
And God bless you too, Brian. Thank you. Thanks for that call. The number is 888-318-7884. I don't know why I'm giving it out because every single line is full, but keep giving it a try. We'd love to have you if you can get through. Joshua in Omaha, which they keep up there in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio, because pretty much if you're listening in Nebraska, you're listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Joshua, thanks for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, this is actually kind of more of a Jimmy Akin question, but I'll ask you guys too, just because I thought it was kind of fun.
What does that mean? It's a Jimmy Akin question. Does that mean like our brains are too small, or that it's kind of
our beards aren't long enough?
Oh, our beards aren't long enough, or is this just a little off the beaten track? This question.
Well, maybe it's because it's more off the beaten track, I would say.
Okay, I'll accept that. I'll accept that. Go ahead, Joshua.
What is the church's teaching on Nephilim? And then how do we know that we're not related to them or that their genetics didn't get passed down to us?
Do you feel like Nephilim, you might be Nephilim, Joshua?
Do you think maybe you are?
Do I? When I was younger, sometimes I was like, oh, maybe, what if I am? But not anymore. No.
Okay.
No,
all right.
Definitely.
All right, Mark Brumley, is your brain big enough to handle this one?
I'll see what I can do. I may have to loosen my headset here a little bit to let my brain expand. So Nephilim, this is a reference to a passage in the book of Genesis in the sixth chapter, where in the Bible it talks about these beings called the Nephilim, Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. It says, that time the Nephilim appeared on the earth, after the sons of heaven had intercourse with the daughters of men, or the sons of God had intercourse with the daughters of men who bore them sons. They were heroes of old, the men of renown. I'm reading from the New American Bible here. I just happened to pick that one up rather than the RSV, which I more typically read from. So people have the idea that somehow the Nephilim were supernatural beings. And of course, there are Jewish traditions and Christian interpretations of these traditions that we'll see it that way. But what the view that I take is that these are sort of mighty men, heroic figures in the Old Testament, and that the sons of heaven here don't refer to angelic beings, but refer to the biblical line of Seth, and the daughters of men refer to the line of Cain, offspring of the line of Cain. And so that we have here just saying that the righteous line intermarried with the line of humanity that had been affected by sin. I don't see this as referring to supernatural beings.
So you would think that the Nephilim are actually just other humans?
Right. That's what I think.
Okay. What do you think, Joshua?
Yeah. I was just curious what you guys thought about it.
That's not as interesting
Let me ask you this, Joshua. If you start displaying what you think are Nephilim-type powers, will you call us back?
Yeah. We want to know about that.
All right. It sounded like you might have had a follow.
Can I call you back if I do it?
Wait, say it again?
Can I call you back if I don't?
Oh, yes. Either way, you're welcome. Yeah, you didn't like wear out your welcome. Did you have a quick follow-up for Mark? It sounded, I thought I heard in your voice there was something you wanted to say, but maybe I misunderstood.
Oh, no. No, I guess the other part of that passage, it says they're there after the flood, too. So, like, they're there before, and then they're there after. I guess in regards to that, I guess my other question was, like, where do the sons of Anak come from? Because they're the giants, and eventually that's kind of where Goliath and his brothers come from. But
the sons
of Anak?
Whom?
I think Anak, or however they say that.
Well, there's nothing in the biblical text that says Enoch's descendants are especially powerful beings or giants or anything.
Hey, Joshua, if you hang on the line, I'd love to send you a wonderful book we have here from Catholic Answers Press called The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics by our guest, Mark Brumley. Hang on, Joshua, because that was a great call. We'll be right back. More Open Forum.
That was fun.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the art of caring.
We'll help you make sure the help you give others is, well, helpful.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of groovy music there for you. And for our guest, Mark Brumley, of whom we are very fond. Mark Brumley, thanks for being with us.
I feel the same about you.
Yeah. All right. I did that whole sentence construction to avoid putting the preposition at the end. See how I did that? Because I thought, Mark's a book publisher. I don't know how he feels about those prepositions.
He might say something.
Yeah.
Don't, to be honest now,
yeah.
Showrunner there. Who's your showrunner?
Darren.
Who actually has that function? Darren would be that. Yeah, of course, Darren's the showrunner. Yeah, duh. I should have known that. I don't even know why I put it that way. Does Darren ever come in and correct your grammar or anything like that?
No. There's so many other problems that I present to Darren before you would get to grammar that the day he corrects my grammar, that's because I had the greatest show ever. Okay, he didn't have anything else he had to say. Like, on the following things, you cross the line. Like, you know, that kind of stuff. And that list is usually so long that we're not getting into grammar.
Yeah. Sorry, Darren. I should have realized you're the showrunner. I don't know what made me think to ask the question about someone else.
Yeah.
Seeing as how
it's easy to forget.
The show and I know that. anyway.
It is. But so you're not here, though. It's easy to forget. Oh, by the way, since you mentioned Darren, I should probably mention Thomas on the phones. And I don't, it's, is it Mary running the cameras? Yeah. Mary's running the cameras. So thanks everybody who's doing that. I'm going to go all the way down to Australia now. Braden in Australia watching on YouTube. We're glad to have you, Braden. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hey, guys. Hey. I've been raised Protestant my whole life, and I think the magisterial view of the Roman Catholic Church has been that it slowly apostatized over time. And I've been reading the book, I can't remember the name of the author, Rod something, the Apostasy That Wasn't.
Rod Bennett.
And he did, yes, that's it. He says in his book that by the year 270, the exact quote was, the church had gone a-whoring. And I was wondering, how would you respond to someone who says that, clearly this does show an early apostasy, and this is what led to the Roman Catholic Church of today?
Well, but Bennett is debunking that idea, though. He's not, Bennett's not claiming that the church was out of whack in the year 270.
He isn't?
No, that's not my understanding of the book. But I don't know the exact line or chapter that you're pointing to. But in general, you'd like Mark to respond to the idea that the church had lost its way in the early centuries, and that there was this great apostasy. Is that right, Braden?
Yeah, because perhaps my understanding is faulty, but I thought he said that Athanasius came along and saved a church which had become too comfortable.
Oh yes. Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Mark, address the great apostasy.
So I'm going to make a distinction between church people, early Christians, and their moral lives, and the core doctrines and moral teachings of church leaders. And it is the case that from time to time, the mass of Christians, will either be more faithful or less faithful, more sinful or less sinful, and even the institutional leadership of the church can be more sinful or less sinful over time. But that's something different from the claim of an apostasy, where the church as a whole or predominantly simply ceases to believe. That's what an apostasy is: falling away from the faith. Or I guess a parallel would be the church wholesale embracing false teachings. And Rod Bennett, among other people, refutes the claim that the early church, the church of the first 200, 300, 400 years, has embraced false teaching, and therefore it's apostatized or fallen away from the true faith of Jesus Christ. And the way in which we can refute the claim of an apostasy is look at some of the distinctive teachings and show how there's a New Testament basis. Look at the generation of church leaders in the immediately following the New Testament time, that generation, the generation after that, and so on. And you'll see a huge continuity in that teaching. So if there were a great apostasy after the New Testament, we would expect to see a radical break in the teaching as it's found in the writings of early church fathers. But we don't see that. We see a radical continuity. Now, that doesn't mean that there's a perfect fidelity to that teaching, that there weren't people that sinned or there weren't heretics that fell away from that teaching. The church as a whole, when you take all of the church fathers, the bishops of the early church and so on, and look at their teachings, you'll see a deep and abiding continuity with what's there in the New Testament. So I think that would be the point. And you'll find distinctively Catholic teachings, things like the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist or the Episcopal structure. I don't say that's distinctively Catholic, because obviously Catholics and Orthodox share that in common, but this basic threefold structure in the church, the church's teaching about the Eucharist, devotion to Mary, a special role for the Bishop of Rome as a successor of Peter, and all of these things, not as refined and spelled out as you find in the Catechism of 1992, but the core elements of these doctrines are found in the teachings of these folks in the late first century, early second century, into the third century. And so it becomes implausible to see that there's some kind of radical break or apostasy in the church in those centuries.
Braden?
That's what I would say.
Does that make sense, Braden, or are we addressing what you wanted?
That does, yeah. Thank you very much for that.
Okay, very, very good. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And a big fan of Rod Bennett and his work. Matter of fact,
you guys published that book by him, and then we published Four Witnesses by Rod Bennett,
right,
which talks about how the early church is Catholic, and then we just came out with a book by him called Four More Witnesses. So
I knew there was a new book coming out. I didn't know it was out already. Okay, Four More Witnesses. Okay, very good.
Yeah,
Ignatius Press. Braden, you let us do a plug for Ignatius Press. That's always good, too. That brings Brumley back if we do that.
Well, it keeps him happy.
All right, now back to Nebraska. A nice break. Take an international trip to Australia. Back to Nebraska. Nolan in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hey, so I was wondering if chewing gum breaks the communion fast.
Good question. A lot of people debate this. I don't think it does, although I do think you ought not to chew gum, certainly not at Mass. I don't think you should, but I don't think it in itself that it amounts to breaking the fast.
I would point out that the great theologian Willy Wonka disagreed with Mark's position on this.
That right?
Yeah. So you don't think it breaks the fast, but this is a debated thing. So we don't have an absolute answer. Okay. Yeah. What do you think, Nolan?
Right. You're not supposed to eat food or consume drink other than water an hour before receiving the Holy Eucharist. And so the question, I guess if you chew the gum and you swallowed it, it would, but the slight amount of intake that comes with chewing gum probably does not, in my opinion, break the fast, but I still think to have when I say break the fast, what I mean is I don't think you are disbarred from receiving the Eucharist. I don't think you're barred from receiving the Eucharist because you chewed gum within the hour. But I do think it contributes to an atmosphere of disrespect to the Eucharist, so you shouldn't do it.
What do you think, Nolan?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you very, very much. I feel like you just settled a bet. It sounded like Nolan had.
That could be, but you know what? This is where Pope Francis talks about getting into these casuistical situations, and I think it's a legitimate question, but I wouldn't want to be too I wouldn't want to put too much on it. Because I think the spirit of the Eucharistic fast is that you not do anything, you not consume anything except water, or if you're on medication, before receiving the Eucharist, and not so much look at, well, what's the minimum or what's the most I can do? What's the minimum I have to do? And what's the most I can do to put something in my mouth and have something going on there,
right,
and not be barred from receiving the Eucharist. I don't think that's really the spirit of the Eucharistic fast.
All right. Nolan, thanks again for the call. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The EWTN home video highlight for January is Life Journey with Sean Carney. 40 Days for Life founder Sean Carney profiles those who have personally confronted the abortion issue themselves and chose life. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Mark Brumley. It's open forum. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Going up to our friend Sean in Fort Perry, Canada, who listens on Alexa. And Sean, before I, let me just get to the right button here. But before I push the button, the other day, they brought this little piece of paper to me and Darren and said, you got to record these things. And it was stuff from the audio version of my book. We had to re-record some stuff. I don't even know why. And you probably know why I'm telling you that, don't you, Sean?
Yes. And I just want to say, before I ask my question, that in my humble opinion, the best Star Trek series was the prequel called The Federation with Captain John Archer.
Oh, what, that was called The Federation? Wasn't that, maybe that was called The Federation in Canada.
It was called Enterprise.
It was called Enterprise down here in America, where they made it.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, right.
That's what, they called it something different up here. Anyhow, Mark, I'm calling about St. Gregory's Prayer Book, which is one of the very few resources available to Anglican, Ordinarian Catholics. And it's published by your company. I guess they wanted to make it small in size, but unfortunately the print is so tiny that I know quite a number of elderly people who just can't even read it. So amongst the things you could think about trying to do would be to bring out a large print edition, or reformulate the existing one to make it somewhat larger and use a thicker and blacker font. So all I'm asking is that you give consideration to that.
Right, and I have to explain, Mark, that Sean has his own vision difficulties, and that's why I had to explain why my book is not out in audio yet, a year after being published,
I
even let him on the air. So you're talking with a man who has experience in this field.
All right. Well, Sean, we will take that under advisement. I will bring that back to the team at Ignatius Press. I thought you were going to add, or you would consider sending a magnifying glass with each copy or something like that. the particular proposals that you made are more sensible. So thank you.
All right, Sean.
Okay. God bless.
Yeah, it's called St. Gregory's Prayer Book. Is that the name of it?
That's what it is.
St. Gregory. But you should call it something different when you send it to Canada. All right.
call it Federation Prayer Book.
Yeah. See you, Sean. I hope you'll call back again soon, all right?
Bye.
Oh, I forgot to ask him about the weather, because it's so cold up in Canada right now. Oh, I should have asked him about that. It always makes me feel better about my life when I hear about the weather in Canada. Michael in Prairieville, Louisiana, listening on Catholic Community Radio, I beg your pardon. You are very welcome here, Michael. Go ahead with your question for Mark Brumley. Wait, Michael dropped? Well, who do I got on the line here? Tell me the name. Who am I talking? All right. We're having slight technical difficulties here. It says, I don't know. Did Michael drop? I have a line 3 call. All right. All right, I'm going to just read Michael's question to you, because we're having some kind of problem. Michael in Prairieville, Louisiana asks this. Do the Gospels recount things in chronological order?
Do the Gospels recount? Broadly speaking, yes, they do recount things in chronological order. So if you look at the Gospel of Mark, for example, I don't know why I would go there, but the Gospel of Mark begins at the beginning of Jesus' ministry and goes through the story of Jesus' ministry all the way to his passion, death, and resurrection. You know, so the Gospel of Matthew starts not just chronologically at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, but, you know, has a whole genealogy of Jesus' ancestry and begins with, you know, even before Jesus is conceived and his conception and the nativity of the Lord and, you know, his and then ultimately his baptism and so on. And Luke does a similar thing. John, of course, whether you can consider the beginning of the Gospel of John chronological depends upon how you define chronology, but John doesn't simply start at the beginning of Jesus's ministry, nor like as Mark does, nor like Matthew and Luke with Jesus's parents, or in the case of St. Joseph, his foster parents, foster father, or even with his genealogy. The Gospel of John starts before all eternity. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So before the creation of the cosmos, the Gospel of John tells us the second person of the Trinity, the Son, was with the Father as the Word. So there is a basic chronological structure to all four of the Gospels, but they have different starting points and therefore different emphases for why they start where they start.
And could I just add a follow-up to that real quick?
Sure.
But my understanding was, and maybe you will correct this, that this within this chronological structure of the Gospels, like say sometimes maybe a guy like Luke or a guy like Matthew, not that there were guys like Luke and Matthew. I mean Luke and I mean the actual Luke and Matthew.
The real guys.
They might collect up several sayings of Jesus and make a little sermon out of it, but we don't necessarily know that the sermon came at that moment. These are kind of collected up.
Yeah, so sometimes like Matthew's gospel batches, as you will, sayings of Jesus into five discourses. And of course, Matthew's gospel is putting an emphasis on Jesus as the new Moses. Moses gave us the Torah and the five books of the Old Testament, first books of the Old Testament. And so this grouping together, the teaching of Jesus, recalls that and points to Jesus' identity as the new Moses. So there's certain freedom that the gospel writers had in ordering their material. But within the basic framework of chronology, they operate. So it's not like they take something that, you know, they don't put the death of Jesus, you know, before the birth of Jesus. They obviously have chronology, a basic chronology. And with respect to Jesus's ministry, that follows after the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist and things of that sort. There's a basic historical chronological structure to the Gospels, even though there is a certain freedom the Gospel writers felt in telling the story of Jesus. They don't contradict that basic historical chronological component.
Michael in Prairieville, I hope that that was helpful to you. Thanks very much for the call. I'm sorry we weren't able to make the connection. I'm going to read you another one, Vince in Sacramento, who is watching on YouTube, because I don't have him on the phone at the moment, but these were the questions they had. Is it okay for Catholics to use modern investment practices like 401ks and such?
Well, I'm not quite sure where he's going with that. On the face of it, it's perfectly fine for Catholics to have retirement accounts. That's what a 401k is, or 403b in the case of not-for-profit organizations. Question may point to is concern about monies being invested in things that are ethically questionable or unethical. And of course, within reason, we should make efforts to try to invest in ethical things and avoid investing in unethical things. The degree to which the average person's 401k or 403b is involved with facilitating evil is so remote that it needn't be a practical concern for many people. For some people, though, where they have substantial investments and they're working with companies that are ethically challenged or maybe ethically indifferent, from a Christian point of view or from a Catholic point of view, it may behoove an investor to say, I need to look at where you're putting my money because I don't want it to be involved with something that's ethically problematic or something that's contrary to my values. So there's nothing wrong with 403Bs or 401Ks per se, nothing wrong with investing per se. And in many instances, or in the instances of most the average people who aren't investing huge sums of money, the extent to which they may be cooperating with things that are ethically problematic is remote. But people with substantial investments in these kinds of accounts should look and see where their monies are being invested, because they may be involved with things that they would find ethically dubious, if not wrong.
All right. Vince in Sacramento, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you for the question. I do have a phone line I can go to now. Will in the Bay Area watching on YouTube. Your line's working, I think, Will. Will, are you there with us?
Hi.
Hey,
hi.
Will.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi.
Oh, we're happy to have it. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Yeah, so this has been kind of like bothering me for a while. I just want some clarification. It has something to do with the parable of the talents. Some people and some religious or leaders say, who are like success, they base it on success, meaning if you have talents to share, then don't hide it from the world. However, something tells me that the emphasis is more like spreading the gospel, because what I fear is when my time comes and I face the Lord, he's going to ask me how many souls have I saved, so to say, if that makes sense.
Yeah, right. It makes sense to me. Mark, does it make sense to you?
Yes. I mean, I think the general idea of the parable of talents is that God gifts us with certain things, and he expects people who receive gifts to use those gifts well to further the work of the kingdom. Now, that can have a very, very specific, very pointed evangelizing sense to it. But I think more general, I think that those who see this as more generally, the gifts of grace and that God has given us in our lives, that he expects us to bear fruit with those things, those gifts. And I think that's really what the parable is talking about. I don't think it's necessarily going to be when, you know, on Judgment Day, you're going to be asked specifically how many people you witnessed to and how many people you led to Christ. That's certainly part of what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ, to be a witness to him. But I think it involves the totality of our lives and how we respond to the gifts that God gives us. The same impetus that says God has given me, say, a gift of teaching, let's say, and therefore I should use that gift of teaching to further the work of the kingdom, is the same spirit that's behind the idea of I've come to know God through Jesus Christ, and therefore this is a gift that I should share with other people. So those are similar things in the life of a disciple who's trying to follow Jesus and do what Jesus wants of him. They won't be readily distinguishable. You know, you're going to say, with all the gifts and talents God has given me, I want to use them in the way that God wants me to use them, and that will bear fruit. Whether that means witnessing to somebody, or it means if I'm talented as a mechanic, using my mechanical talents to further the work of the kingdom, which can mean helping people with their automobiles and things of that sort. So I don't think we should pit these ways of looking at that parable against one another, but I think they represent sort of an all-inclusive, how do we utilize the gifts and talents that God has shared with us? And that includes furthering the work of the kingdom, which can involve witnessing to people.
Will, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much. Mark Brumley has been our guest. Mark Brumley is the president of Ignatius Press. Check him out at ignatius.com. And they've got that new translation of the Henri de Lubac book from the Second Vatican Council. So you might want to look for that one, too. It's not a long book. Mark,
is it? No, it's very, very short, very readable.
Perfect for our times where we are still trying to figure out what the council was about. Mark Brumley, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, sir.
I hope we'll get to talk soon. All right. Tomorrow's Friday. Oh, 2 hours with Jimmy Akin, your Bible questions. You can ask anything you want about the Bible, where it came from, who wrote it, what it means, what a particular passage means. All welcome tomorrow. Ask your Bible questions, Jimmy Akin. We'll see you then. God willing, Catholic Answers Live.